Folks, when you look at this podcast in your various apps, it'll show the category which the podcast is uploaded to. Is it spirituality and religion? No. Is it science and mathematics? No, it is not. Is it nature? No, not there at all. It's none of those things, okay? People will be asking, is it arts and entertainment? Some may argue yes, but this week, no, the category is firmly business because that's what we're getting down to. We are getting down to business in this week's podcast. We're talking about the TV shows. We're talking about the new one from Apple TV Plus. It's called The New Look. We're talking about the movies. This is one playing in a cinema called Madam Web. I think we're bypassing discussion about the Bob Marley biopic. We'll talk about why. I mean, long story, short answer, Simon went on holidays, didn't watch any movies. I guess that's probably it. Anyway, folks, this is Screen Watching. We'll be coming back on the other side of this here opening theme song with some reviews and some discussion about the movies and TV industries and some general thoughts and quizzes and stuff. There's a lot of podcasts we do every week. That is why, people, this is a business podcast.
Not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Folks, this is Screen Watching. My name, Dan Barrett, joined as always by the chairman of the board, Simon Foster.
Apart from those few weeks when I went on holidays, yes, I have been here for the whole duration of the festival chairman of the board. I like that. Hello, Dan Barrett. Hello, Screen Watchers. It is a joy to be here in a week when records have been broken. I just want to run through very quickly, and I want to get your comment on this, Dan Barrett. Three significant records were broken this week. Jon Stewart's return, and you're going to talk about this later in the segment, in the review section. 1.9 million viewers, the biggest episode since 2018. One, record broken. Two, Marvel Studios' highly anticipated trailer for Deadpool and Wolverine broke global records on Monday, scoring 365 million views in 24 hours, the most viewed movie trailer of all time. Boom, record broken. Number three, the Super Bowl game between the Kansas City Chiefs and the San Francisco 49ers brought in an average of 123.7 million viewers, the highest number of people watching the same broadcast in the history of television. That is a lot of screen watching in a week when people had nothing better to do but watch their screens, apparently. So I think the message of the podcast is getting out there.
Okay, I didn't think we really had much sway on this versus, say, Taylor Swift, but we'll go with it. First of all, I think that's saying that The Daily Show achieved its highest rating since 2018. Faint praise. I don't have the figures in front of me. I want to say off the top of my head that when Jon Stewart was last hosting the show, it was doing an average of about 1.8 to 2 point something million viewers a night, which wasn't a high by Jon Stewart. Like, that diminished somewhat. But during the time of Trevor Noah, you know that phrase that people use when you're a good steward of something? You know, I'm not sure what phrase people use, but usually when you say someone's been a good steward of something, they've looked after things. They've, you know, kept things in shape. The viewership for The Daily Show under Trevor Noah towards the end was certainly, look, our podcast occasionally reaches figures which are comparable. Okay. You know. Okay. Good for us.
All right. Okay, good to know.
Yeah. So in terms of the viewership for the trailer, are they including people that saw it during the Super Bowl? Is that how that figure's so high?
No, I think that was in the 24 hours post its premiere, like when it hit online. It was the most
viewed. Yeah, but are they only counting online viewership? Yeah, but are they only counting that YouTube viewership, or are they also including the TV broadcast viewership as well? Because that's
no, no, only online, only on the YouTube viewership. Yeah,
so that's, well, it won't be just YouTube. So they'll be including into that one, Simon, viewing on X, formerly known as Twitter, and Threads, and the other platforms that they put it up on.
Oh, sure. Yep. There you go. All right, that's a big week of record-breaking movie of screen watching, so I'm very happy. Did you watch the Super Bowl? I know you're a big American football fan and a big Taylor Swift fan. So I assume you were on the couch with the popcorn and the Cheetos and just watching the game?
No.
Just like that. No. I didn't. I was away for it, sunning myself on the crocodile-infested beaches of Cairns in far north Queensland. But I did watch a little bit of the game when I got back here and saw – did you see Taylor skull the wine? Boy, that's Simon, she's one of the people's.
I didn't watch her. I haven't seen nothing.
It was a hell of a broadcast. Anyway, we really should get onto the review segment.
Yeah, we're not here to talk about TV. Jeez, Simon.
It stinks.
Okay, two big releases this week, and this probably touches upon a little bit of what we're going to discuss in the intermission as well, which is changing viewing and whatnot. Look, I think that a lot of the big conversations we have in this podcast is really going to come to the forefront when we talk about Madam Web. So before we lose ourselves in the threaded spiral of web, let's maybe go into the safer territory and talk about the brand new Apple TV Plus show. It's called The New Look.
Parisian couture could influence how thousands of ordinary women dream and live. But fashion needs a new leader. A figurehead. Monsieur Dior.
Here's what you need to know about the show, and this is what had me interested in the show. Three words, Todd A. Kessler. Now, Todd A. Kessler, he is a TV showrunner, creator, done programs like Damages and Bloodlines for Netflix. These are the two big programs he's had. So when there's a new program being announced for that Todd A. Kessler is involved in, okay, it's worth paying attention to. So this one's this new series for Apple TV Plus. It's called The New Look, and it's a inspired by real events. That's probably an important thing. It's a tag right at the beginning of every episode. Inspired by real events, it's a biographical TV drama, which is about the mid-World War II and post-World War II activities of Christian Dior and Coco Chanel, as played by Ben Mendelsohn and Juliette Binoche. You can guess which one plays which. I'm probably not going to spell that out for you.
Figure it out.
Yeah. So look, Todd A. Kessler, interesting, because the thing with Todd Kessler programs, his joints are, they are programs which are rich in character. They have really propulsive narrative engines behind them. Like, they are TV at its most pure and its most watchable. So the idea of them doing this on a big budget Apple TV Plus show with the cast of this one, like I mentioned Mendo, I mentioned Bino, I didn't mention Maisie Willow, Maisie Williams from Game of Thrones. She's in there playing Catherine Dior, the sister of Christian Dior. John Malkovich is in there. Emily Mortimer pops up. Like, there's some really good, likable, enjoyable TV and film presences within this. So, you know, you are not short of some pretty big names. Also, Glenn Close is in the first season, but we won't talk about that just yet. Big names on this program. So, Todd A. Kessler, propulsive TV, great subject matter, great budget, great cast. Why is this TV show so boring to watch? Why is this so lifeless? I know Simon loved this program, but he's wrong on this one. It is a real snore of a TV program. So I've watched the first three episodes, and this is what debuts on night one when debuts on Apple TV Plus, which I want to say is Thursday or Friday this week. It might be mere hours from when we're recording this, Simon.
It is. Yes.
The problem is, for a TV creator who is so well known for creating propulsive TV, the first 3 hours cover the same ground in really slow, minute detail across all three episodes. It starts out with this really sort of interesting, hey, we're post-World War II by about 10 years. I think it's in the early to mid-50s when the opening sequence takes place. Mm-hmm. And you see Juliette Binoche's character, Coco Chanel. I just gave it away, which one's which. You see Coco Chanel, and she's trashing Christian Dior. Christian Dior, meanwhile, is the toast of Paris. He is about to present a conversation to a whole bunch of design, like costume not costume, like clothing design enthusiasts and students, and people are really into Christian Dior and the new look, the we'll call it, for want of another phrase, the new wave of fashion that's coming through France at the time. So you've got this thing, and there's a lot of energy behind both of these opening sequences, and both of them are Coco Chanel is talking to journalists, and the sort of conversation comes up about World War II through that. Christian Dior is involved in this panel chat, and a student gets up and asks him a question about his willingness to be continuing to work through World War II, creating fashions for the elites within the Nazi party. Because obviously Paris was taken over by Nazis for quite a few years there. So anyway, he's sort of like, yes, well, interesting you talk about that. And then it's a bit of Wayne's World, doo-doo, 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 as we see like the flashback take place. And so for the next three episodes, we're stuck in this really turgid story where it's basically Maisie Williams as Catherine Dior. She's like, hey, I'm a revolutionary. Let's go and, you know, bring down these Nazis. And everyone's like, yeah, that's all pretty good. And Ben Mendelsohn's wearing a suit and he's a bit sort of dour about it all and whatnot. But he's providing some space for the revolutionaries to live in his apartment. So he's not entirely against the idea of it. He's a good guy. He's a cool dude. But then, wait a second, Catherine Dior, captured by Nazis, taken to a concentration camp to work in. Now, what she's up to, which we only see snippets of in the third episode, way more interesting than anything that Christian Dior's doing to try to get her back. Like, it's... I don't understand why we needed three episodes to cover the ground that we did when we're really focused in all the wrong places as part of this storyline. I'm looking forward to episode four because it gets us back to more modern day Paris, presumably. As the end of the third episode ends, we see it's the end of World War II. So I'm guessing episode four is maybe the business of getting Catherine Dior back into Christian's life. Or we go back to modern day and we're now sort of more modern day France. But look, if anyone makes it to the end of this three episodes, you're doing it purely because of the very lush production values and great cast on this one, because outside of that, the show just has nothing to offer. It's not covering any new territory. It's not covering interesting territory. It is excess for excess's sake. Everyone got paid nicely and good on them, but I wasn't being paid to watch it.
Okay, well, I disagree with big chunks of that. It is a very handsomely mounted production in that regard, you're right. Having not seen and unable to compare Kessler's past work in Damages and Bloodline, I can't speak to his skills as a storyteller across multiple seasons of things, but I've seen all 10 episodes of this, I think. And he tells a compelling, very vast, very expansive story, not just of the two people central to this storyline in Coco Chanel and Christian Dior, but also of the broader resistance movement, of Coco's involvement with Claes Bung, who plays a Nazi operative who's able to infiltrate the French high society. This felt like very old-fashioned and very traditional in the way it told its story, but also really compelling and very sort of satisfying in a sturdy piece of television drama way. It's helped that it looks beautiful, of course, not just the fashions, which really come to the fore later in later episodes, but also in its recreation of the period. What are you waving your hand at?
I want to ask a few questions. First of all, when you were talking about the expansive cast of revolutionaries, is this post episode four onwards, or are you referring to these first three episodes?
Throughout the 10 episodes, there is a significant subplot about the revolutionaries coming back into Christian Dior's life, especially without giving too much away when Maisie Williams re-enters the scene.
Yeah, look, the second thing you said was that this is sort of very traditional TV. I actually don't think that's the case at all, and this is where I think the problem is. I think that so many of the problems that we're seeing in the first couple of episodes of this show, and if we're going to look at... So I've really embraced this idea recently that the only things that should be reviewed are episodes that are available for people to watch on week one of a program, because I really don't care for what is the new way of storytelling, and it's that phrase that I think everybody's grown really tired of, which is wait till episode five, that's when it gets really good. The thing is, to get to episode five, that's an investment.
Yeah, but that's in response to the binging. But they're telling that they're belling that sort of storytelling in response to the binging of programs. So that is how TV is being told now.
Yeah, but no, that's actually not really entirely true, because you started seeing this happen. The first time I really remember people talking at excess with the phrase of, I'll wait till episode five, that's when it gets good, is The Wire. And in fairness to The Wire, like, episode five was when it started getting really good. So, you know, there was certainly merits to that one. But The Wire was also taking place at a time where it was pre-binge really being the main viewing delivery mechanism for it. I think most people started watching The Wire a couple of years after it was made on DVD. And so people were legitimately binge watching it on DVD, if people remember that way, that arcane way that we once watched TV for a little while there.
But it wasn't as prominent as...
Yeah, to get to that idea, though, where you're saying that people are watching things, binge watching, and it's like, wait till episode five for it to get good. Like, this is a complete result of the streaming revolution. Okay, and part of the problem with streaming, since it really kicked off, became the primary way that people are watching, we'll call them premium TV dramas, because I don't care for the word prestige. As we start thinking about these sort of premium TV dramas, what we saw was an influx of a lot of movie people and aspiring movie people coming to make TV and telling a two-hour movie across 10 episodes, rather than people who are legitimately great TV storytellers and understand the medium to the point where they can really sort of derive the maximum out of a serialized story engine, which is what TV is. It is serialized, and you know it's serialized because every 48 minutes to 52 minutes, there's these things called closing credits, and then there's opening credits. It's not just one story. Like, there is, it is serialized. Like, that is what TV is. There is a structure to it. We can look at this, say that, oh, well, waiting five episodes for it to get good has become a function of streaming TV, but that's only because there was a whole bunch of bad TV storytellers that flooded into the market. The majority of the really good shows that we're watching were things where week to week or episode to episode, we are watching things that felt like a complete story through that. Watching the first three episodes back is a real disappointment, because Todd A. Kessler was really good at that episodic, like that ability to tell a grander story over the course of one season, while every installment of it felt like it was actually doing something which was standing on its own, something which was actually worthy of the viewer's time and investment. I kind of feel as though we're at a point now where people don't have the time or inclination to want to wait 5 hours for something to get good. You should be able to give someone something which is worthwhile to watch for that first episode, encourage them to come back for the second episode, and not just this promise that it's going to get good at some point, because you're watching 2.5 movies to get to the point of when it gets good, and that's not good enough.
Disagree, strong disagree, because people are choosing not to watch, not to give a single episode a go and hope to be hooked for the next 10 episodes. Binge watching is now people saying, okay, here's the new Ben Mendelsohn, Juliet Binoche show. I'm gonna hit and blast through those first three episodes. That's why Apple are dropping three episodes, because they know people are on board for the long haul of this. They're not saying, I'll see what the first episode is like. Yeah. They're going to go forward and say, I'm going into this. And if by episode six or seven that it starts to peter out and they say, I made a mistake with this, I'll drop out, well and good.
No.
People have been doing since the dawn of television. I don't think I have. I think this is a very significant change in the way people are deciding what to view on television.
No, you've missed it. So here's the thing. People who watched the first three episodes and – People will watch the first three episodes and I'll make their viewing decision at that point. This is why I'm making it that policy of only watching episodes that are available to the public from that first episode, from that first sort of viewing experience. I want to be able to have a conversation about what people are going to experience when I'm making that viewing decision, okay? I don't think that it is fair to someone when I'm offering my thoughts on something to say that, sure, the three episodes that you've just watched then weren't particularly engaging, but come back in two episodes' time when it's going to get quite good. I don't think that's good enough, and I don't think people want to hear that anymore. I think people want to know, if I watch episode one, two, and three, which is available on the first day that it's released, is that going to be worthy of my time? Because people make their purchasing decision on that first episode, okay? If there's three episodes available, they may stick around for all three episodes. But you're going to watch three episodes back to back here, which are telling the exact same story repeated over three different episodes. It doesn't have anywhere
near. Well, I think that's a misinterpretation of those first two episodes. I disagree. I don't think they make it based on the first episode. They're not saying I'm going to see what the first episode is like and then keep decide if I keep coming back or not.
That's exactly how people make viewing decisions.
The way TV watching goes at the moment is that the way the TV watching goes at the moment are people are saying, I'm going into this willing to commit to the long haul of watching it. If the first few episodes don't get me in, then that's a whole different thing. But the decision is being made to binge out a series. That's what's being committed to at this stage.
The number of times that you've come on here talking about a really good show, and then I ask you a couple of weeks later,
let me just make a point.
And then you're like, oh no, I'm no longer watching it. That actually speaks to the way that people watch TV. They don't necessarily stick with something unless it's something which has really sort of hit them in that way where they want to reinvest their time again week after week. It's very easy to move on to the next thing.
Let me also make the point that as reviewers, if we're afforded all 10 episodes of the series, should we not give some perspective of what the entirety of the storytelling amounts to?
If we're
given that privilege and that opportunity, shouldn't we do that?
No, because I think that there is two things that go on with that. So one, I think it's perfectly, I think there's an argument to be made saying that, yes, you should. But I've taken the viewpoint that we shouldn't, because the way that critics are often provided screeners isn't necessarily that same experience every time. Sometimes you're provided a full season. Sometimes you're provided the first two episodes. Sometimes it's the first four of 10 episodes. We're not given the same clear grounding on every case. And so I think that as a critic, you need to come at things and give it an equal foundation to where you're offering your thoughts on. So I really don't like the idea of having to offer a review one week where I'm able to say, hey, this is what happens in the entire season, okay, and here's why you should stick with the program, when for the next thing I review, suddenly I can't actually do that. It's so varied in the actual release structure of it all that I just don't think that it's fair to me to have to waver all over the place in terms of that, or to the viewers of whom are like, oh, Dan offered his thoughts on this, he was completely wrong on this one because it got really good on episode 5 or 6, but he was really wrong on that one. And it's like, well, I didn't have access to those episodes. So I've just made this decision saying I will only talk about the episodes that are available for people on that first time that they're making a purchasing decision. So for me this week, this show has got 3 episodes available. I watched the 3 episodes, but I'm not going to watch all 10 episodes because one, my purchasing decision at the end of these first 3 episodes is I don't think I'm going to stick with this program because I don't think it's really up to scratch. I think that they're wasting a lot of people's time. I watched 150 minutes of this program and I was entertained for 7 of them.
I watched 600 minutes of it and I was wildly entertained by all of them. So I guess it's just a perspective thing, a context thing. All right, okay, so the new look is on Apple TV. Mendo's good. I did read the Variety review that said he was woefully miscast, which I thought was very strange because I thought he was terrific in the role. Are you on the side of Mendo, thumbs up or thumbs down?
I'm always just excited to see Mendo on the screen. There's that. I do think he's miscast. Like, he feels like he's – this is the thing with Mendo. Obviously, he's an Australian actor. But when I see him on screen, I think of him as an American actor. I just don't think that he really imbues a Europeanness about him. I don't think that he really embodies an Australianness about him anymore. I think he's kind of moved on to, because he's been in so many American productions now. I think that his innate sort of approach to the work comes at it from a very American perspective. When I look at this, I just don't see a European up on screen, let alone a very specific French man. And I think that's a problem, particularly when he's up against Juliette Binoche, who is very French, and she looks and feels very French. Maisie Williams, who obviously British, but, you know, close enough. You can kind of, you can make that reach. And I think John Malkovich, as an actor, has a very sort of European sense about him just generally. So he kind of fits in here a little bit more as well. But yeah, Mendo, I don't know, I don't think he's given enough to really do in this program from what I've seen. The 150 minutes of it that I've seen, I don't think he's been given anywhere near enough in terms of a character to really sort of bite into. I don't think there's any real texture to him. He's just a empty suit walking around getting involved in shenanigans with Nazis.
rest assured, I I'm 180 degrees opposite to that opinion, but it'll be keen to see how it plays out. In cinemas at the moment, this week's big superhero film release is called Madam Web.
A week ago, I spent my life racing against time.
I'm going to help you out today, okay?
Trying to save people who are running out of it.
Getty!
Until one moment changed everything.
Welcome back to the Land of the Living.
Now, it's going to be interesting how you and I come at this film, Dan, because I know from your comic book days you brought, and you mentioned this in your newsletter through the week, always be watching, that there are elements of this that will be recognisable to the comic book reader that were not immediately recognisable to me. This is the story of Cassandra Webb, who, through a fairly convoluted backstory, develops the ability to see flashes of the future moments before it's about to happen. She decides that is something that she's going to have to try to embrace, try to be part of her persona, especially when it involves the futures of three young women who she sees in a very tense and exciting sequence on board a train are about to be murdered by this black suit wearing, roof climbing bad guy. So she goes on the run with these women, with these young women. Terrific young actresses.
Can I ask a question? You mentioned the bad guy. What's his name?
The actor or?
Character. The bad guy.
Ezekiel.
Actually did know it. Okay. Sorry. I just assumed you wouldn't know it. We'll get to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Celeste O'Connor, Isabella Merced, and the super hot right now Sydney Sweeney play the three young women. And so what sets in motion is sort of a superhero movie that isn't really a superhero movie because it doesn't quite have a superhero at the center of it. It has a supervillain, and it's an origin story for a character who I'd never heard of prior to the pre-promotion for this film, played by Dakota Johnson. Big Dakota Johnson fan. I'm very happy with the way she took on the Marvel superhero duties in this. She feels like a very real person who had these abilities forced upon her and had to kind of deal with it in the best way she could. We often speak about films of our youth, those mid-tier films that kind of came along and were programmers or slightly elevated programmers. And I think that Madam Web certainly falls into that category that would have included The Shadow back in the day or The Phantom or those sort of superhero films that were sort of lower tier ones, but wholly satisfying in their own way. The web is already, and no pun intended, but the internet is already blown up. It's at 70% on Rotten Tomatoes. The fanboys have come out and ripped it to shreds for whatever reasons. I think they're assholes. I think this is a perfectly watchable, not a particularly rousing film or even a really good one in many ways, but it is a perfectly watchable movie that I found myself engaged with when the action scenes cut in, final scenes on top of the Pepsi Cola building I thought were great, and that sequence on the train I thought was brilliantly edited and really well cut together. So look, this is a film that's been delayed. The shoot was delayed, the release was delayed. It's finally getting here. It's funny seeing Sydney Sweeney and Isabella Merchant, who are now much bigger actresses than they were when they filmed this. Even if this was a huge success, I can't see him coming back to play the roles that are sort of touched on in this. But in every other regard, I thought this was a pretty good superhero movie. Now, we're sort of on your turf here, Dan. This is kind of something that I'm sure we'll have a lot of opinions on. What were your thoughts on the movie?
Look, so first of all, just because it's based on a comic book doesn't necessarily mean that anyone who's into comic books is suddenly right across that or necessarily in the camp of it. I think it's probably just important to realize that I grew up largely as a DC kid. This is playing very much in that Marvel sandbox. Madam Web character, I kind of knew, but not from comics, but she was a fixture through season 3 of the early 90s Spider-Man cartoon, which I was a pretty big fan of back in the day.
doesn't mean I'm going to know anything about it, and then you drop on me season 3 of the Spider-Man cartoon.
you're missing the thing I was about to follow through with my next sort of statement here, which was I know her from this cartoon series. I know that she's like a big part of season three of the show. That show went for about 5 seasons, and on the 5th season, she makes a bit of an appearance back in there. Okay, and she's a pivotal character in this. Interestingly, she is not a hot 30-something like Dakota Johnson, which I'm a big fan of. Dakota Johnson is not a phrase I've heard from anybody in the history of humanity, and I don't expect I'll ever hear again. But, you know, you do you, Simon Foster. The Madame Web of the cartoons, and as I discover the comic books, not a hot 30-something, but instead a 70, 80-year-old woman. Okay, so really quite a different character in so many ways. But I thought that she was actually created for the cartoon show, and I didn't realize that she actually had any presence in the comics at all. Like, I thought this was just like a weird thing they did in the cartoon. But apparently she was in the comics. She's not a major character by any means. The only reason this movie exists is because Sony have the rights to the Spider-Man character for movie opportunities. And so that's why they make the Spider-Man movies, with Marvel getting involved in that now. Okay, but they also have the right to do all the offshoot characters from Spider-Man. So when they looked in the treasure trove of Spider-Man related characters, one of the ones they came across was Madame Web. So they've taken the name and the overall, I guess, idea of a spider orientated person who can kind of see through time and, I guess, reach out to other spider people, and just took that as an idea and ran with it in an entirely different direction. So I don't know that the Madame Web character really represents all that much of what people know her from in the comics. It's the movie is essentially its own thing.
Great. On that basis,
So like when you come into it, you're just as cleanly coming into it as any other person. So if you've experienced Spider-Man in any of the cross media from like the last 30 plus years, like, you know enough to be able to carry through this one. So you mentioned in there a phrase along the lines of the fanboys have turned against this one. Like, the fanboys don't care about Madame Web. Like, that is not a thing that's going on. But broadly, this has become one of these movies at the moment where it's become very cool to sort of crap on it a bit. And in fairness, it's not a great movie, but also it's not as bad as most of the commentary around this film suggests at the moment. Like, it is... And you kind of beat me to what I wanted to talk about here, which was this is the superhero equivalent of a programmer. And it's exactly what you were saying. This is no different to those action-adventure programmers from throughout the 90s and early 2000s. You could look at The Shadow, you could look at The Phantom, you could look for another Marvel character of like Daredevil or the Elektra movie, all those sorts of films. And the Elektra movie is legitimately a really terrible movie. The Daredevil movie was just a bad movie that had some fun and engaging moments. And that's kind of what you got here with Madame Web. There is a few sequences in it, which I genuinely, I'm not sure exciting is the word, but they're definitely, there's that moment where you shift from being a viewer of a movie to suddenly actually being in the world of a movie when you're watching it. Like, you lose track of the world. You actually get absorbed into the movie. And I will admit, there was maybe 2 or 3 sequences in this where I found myself getting absorbed into it. But every time I found myself getting absorbed in, I was also being pushed back from the movie by just 1 or 2 stupid things that were always taking place in it. And almost every time I was being pushed out of the movie was largely from the bad guy, who apparently was named Ezekiel, but I couldn't have told you that while I was watching the movie. He is just a nothing villain where there's a lot of ADR taking place around the actor playing him. It really feels as though he's not much of a character at all, and he isn't much of a character. And it feels as though if a lot of things got changed in the post-production of this film, which apparently they did, I think it was largely orientated around that villain. And that's kind of where the problem with the movie comes from. You've got a film which is, it's a superhero film, but it's also not a superhero film. But part of being sort of adjacent to that as a genre means that you need a villain that you can kind of latch onto and root for the heroes to beat. And you don't have a villain to root against because he's kind of nothing. And that's the biggest problem with this movie.
I disagree with that.
The editing and the sound design is also kind of rubbish, and that doesn't help, particularly in the first half hour of this movie. But anyway, sorry, Simon.
The point I want to make about the villain is that I thought he provided a legitimate bridge between the opening prologue where we see Cassie's mother down in the Peruvian forest and we first come across the spider people of the jungle. Well, that's a sentence I never thought I'd say. And also the use of that flash forward, seeing into the future component that affects Cassie Webb, and how, and especially in that scene where we get to glimpse the three young women in, as the superheroes that they may become, sending him to his demise. I thought that Tahir Rahim, who played the character, it had that stupid sequence where they sit in front of a laptop and they're able to access all the city cameras and follow and face track all the girls so that he knows where to go to get them to kill them. I thought that was dumb. But I thought that the actual villain himself was a really good presence. And, you know, there was some sequences, the diner fight, and then the scene where Adam Scott, who is really just baggage in this film, but is, you know, doing what he has to do, where they're racing to get Emma Roberts to the hospital and the villain shows up. I thought he had a menacing presence. I didn't think he was a bad villain. So I kind of disagree with you on that one, but it is, the stakes seem very small. I think why I was engaged with it so much is that because it wasn't some smart alecky white guy at the front of this. I like the fact that the leads were four relatively young women doing things that you maybe didn't expect them to get away with at the time. At any given time, one of those three girls, it wouldn't have been untoward for one of them to meet their end at the hands of this villain to propel the story. So I thought there was a legitimate bit of tension there.
Look, I don't think there was any tension there at all, because largely what you're seeing with these three girls is that it's kind of the pre-origin story for the three of them. And it's kind of what this movie is. So I don't, because look, I mean, I've seen the box office projections for where this movie's going this weekend, and I've seen the reviews. This movie is not getting a sequel. That is not going to happen. But I could easily see a scenario where they decide to, you know, take a large amount of money to Sydney Sweeney and say, hey, look, do you want to continue your character over into like a new film? And then they give her a proper origin and bring those other characters in as supports. And maybe there's a brief Madam Webb cameo in there, and Dakota Johnson's convinced to come back as well. Like, you know, maybe that sort of thing happens. And I'd be actually pretty happy to see that happen, because by the time I reached the end of this movie, I kind of wanted to see where these characters were going to have their moment, which would actually turn them into superheroes. Because by the end of this movie, they're still just teenage girls. Like, nothing's actually happened. But we do know from watching the movie.
Yeah, it's a superhero movie without a superhero. That's the thing.
Well, I mean, that's technically, it does have a superhero in it, in that Peter Parker is a fetus within the movie, because there's this weird inexplicable decision they've made to tie it as closely to Spider-Man as possible, where literally Mary Parker, the mother of Spider-Man, is a supporting character. The Adam Scott character you mentioned is Ben Parker, who eventually becomes the legal ward of Peter Parker after Mary Parker dies, because I think they're going to reveal that she's still alive, because they've just cast a really big actress in that role. In the comics, it turns out that his parents were secretly super spies and were running around the world. What? And it's just ridiculous. We'll get to that in a second, though, because that ties in something I want to talk about this film. But there's just all these things to ground the storyline in 2003, when the Tom Holland version of Spider-Man would have, you know, been a fetus. So you do see a sequence where Mary Parker is going to the hospital to give birth to the future Peter Parker. So, like, that's taking place. But outside of the Spider-Man connection, like, outside of the Peter Parker connection, there's no reason the film needs to be set in 2003. It may as well just be set.
Oh, there were some great needle drops. No. There were some great needle drops for music of that time. The use of Britney Spears' Toxic, that great wall mural of 2003 Beyoncé was such a rush. That was a pretty cool moment. And I thought the film...
Well, also, sorry, Simon, just the needle drops. Simon, there were so many songs from pre-2003 that they easily could have had a film in 2023, 2024, and just had Britney Spears in there. It doesn't change that soundtrack or the spirit of what they were doing with that soundtrack.
I also thought it was a great-looking film. I thought that opening sequence in New York, there's been some complaint that it takes a little while to get going. I've read in some reviews, and I disagree. I thought setting up that whole thing with them as the two ambulance officers and the way some of those night sequences in New York were shot before even the superhero and the supervillain stuff kicks in was really cool. You want to make a quick point. We need to move on. What was the quick point?
Yeah, sorry. Visually, it's fine. But the problem is the sound design and I think some of the direction and editing on those opening sequences, because it just feels empty. that's where the criticisms of the New York sequences are coming into it. It doesn't really feel as though it's particularly vibrant or exciting. And that's the problem with the villain. Like, it is not a vibrant, interesting character. You mention all these things of which, oh, you know, he did all these things, but that was all just narrative. It wasn't actually an interesting character to watch. He's the new look of superhero villains. He's just an empty suit, which is just serving narrative function for no real payoff for the viewer, which is super frustrating. But one of the things that really frustrates me with superhero narratives is this idea that it's not enough for a character to just go and do one thing. There's always, you know, sometimes 6 months, sometimes like 15, 30 years later when some other writer's doing it, saying, oh, here's what you didn't really know about that scene. So traditional Spider-Man lore had it that Peter Parker's parents died when he was a kid. His aunt and uncle take him in, and then he gets bit by a spider and gets these superhero powers. And that's enough. When you start overloading it with, oh, what you didn't really know is that his parents were actually secret spies who were traveling around Europe, and Spider-Man's got this whole other like aspect to him. It's overloading it too much. It's just silly. But this movie, it is Madame Web, and part of it is that this character acts as this center point, a fulcrum that connects and moves the destiny of all these other spider-orientated people. So the three teenage girls in her aren't superheroes yet, but we know they're going to become superheroes. And so she is the character that kind of brings them all into the web of Madame Web. Okay. And then there's a connection between the villain and her mother, and then the connection between her and Peter Parker and Ben Parker and all of that. Ordinarily, that's super convoluted, but it actually works at the heart of what this film is actually really about, which is a character who is involved in the middle of the web of the Spider-Verse and is kind of moving things around and connecting things where ordinarily there wouldn't be connections. I actually kind of like that in here. Even the terrible sequences, which get all CGI with her in like some sort of nebulous space where there's spider webs all around her and she's like just connecting to stuff and it's just CG wank. Even that was actually kind of valid and worth watching, because that was kind of the core of what the character is. It was a decent visual representation of it. All the silliness is kind of waved away by the very premise of this movie. Like, I kind of bought into a lot of it. It's not a good movie. I think that a lot of it is very, very flat. But if I saw this on the TV, I'd be more than happy to watch it again at some other point. And also, I kind of want to see the sequel, which is never going to happen, but maybe the spin-off or in-universe films that'll inevitably sort of spin out of this, because they do have a very famous Sydney Sweeney as part of this narrative now, and that'd be crazy not to try to build a film around her.
Alrighty, that's Madame Web from Sony Pictures in cinemas as we speak. I think it's time for the intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
Something different for this week's intermission. This week, or just over the past week, we got an email from a listener, the good man, Tony Kendall. I don't know, him could be a friend, who knows. He's certainly a friend of the podcast. Thanks for listening and thanks for writing. He wrote to us, and I paraphrase this a little bit, but it's essentially what he says. Dear Dan, he says, clearly he has no idea that you don't read the emails, but that's all right. I watched the Actor Awards, as I'm sure you and Simon did. Second mistake you've made. Did you watch the Actor Awards, Dan?
No.
Much like the Super Bowl, I watched bits of it later on. And he wrote, I'd be interested to hear your views on something. Okay, this is what Tony says. Why is it that Australia is making TV content that's crossing over very well overseas? And he lists Josh Thomas's Everything's Going to Be Okay and Bluey, Deadlock that's getting a second season, Colin from Accounts. I'd also add to that things like Safe House and the locally shot NCIS, so he makes a good point. But he says all the best 2023 actor nominated films were quote unquote disastrous flops. I'll come back to that. That no one here saw and wanted to see. And it was also the same last year with what got nominated. The 2023 best film winner Talk to Me was okay, but was a modest hit here. Why do you think the Oz film industry here has gone to shit in regularly making mediocre and or uninteresting films that people here just aren't interested in supporting either in cinemas or when they go to streaming at home? Tony Kendall. Valid points. Let me respond first. And they were just a couple of things I probably want to take to task, and I think you'll know where I'm going to go with this, Dan.
Sorry, I'm just going to get my peeping mask and everything. Yeah, sorry, go. Where's my pillow?
First of all, let's talk about the modest hit that you called Talk to Me, Tony. It was released in the 73 countries. It took $92 million globally, just shy of $3 million here in Australia. That was based on a budget of US $4.5 million. So it is not a modest hit. It is a major, major profit center for everybody involved. It has become the independent studio A24's second highest grossing domestic film in the US of all time, only behind the phenomenon that was Everything Everywhere All at Once, and better than films and much sort of higher profile films than Hereditary or Midsommar or the Oscar winner Moonlight or the Oscar winner Whale or the Oscar winner The Room. So this is a major, major hit for an Australian film, either way you look at it. The other point you made was that last year nobody gave a shit about the films and nobody went and saw them. That's not true. Last year's a bad comparison to that because last year was Elvis on a grand scale and The Drover's Wife on a smaller scale. So last year, maybe not the best example, but I'm not poo-pooing your points. I do think you make some valid points in there about why the TV content is working so well. I would say that there's an abundance of outlets for the TV content now. So the fact that more shows are getting made and shipped to more countries around the world is because there's now more outlets for it to go into. I know you'll have an opinion on that, Dale. But I also want to make the point that the point with the term disastrous flops. Now, that means that we're coming at this debate from a financial point of view, and we don't have a commercial film industry. That's what needs to be drilled into those that say that nobody goes to see these movies. We're an artistic film industry. We are run by people who have a very clear mindset as to what they think the art form should be in the hands of our filmmakers. So we have to hit very specific points when we're writing a script and when we're putting a film together to make sure that it has social value, to make sure that it has diversity, to make sure that it has all the very positive elements that should be embraced in all these films.
But, you're just losing me there for a moment. Sorry, go on.
But it's also to that point, we are creating art. So when you have a look at the films that were made, that were nominated for the films this year, we had a film called Shader, which was our international foreign film Oscar entry. We had Warwick Thornton's The New Boy, which in fact was a hit at the cinemas on an art house scale. Same with The Royal Hotel, same with Of an Age, same with Sweet As. These are all films that reflect exactly what our people in charge of our industry are trying to reflect in our cinema. Socially conscious films with diversity and very positive traits at their center, not films that are trying to be huge or want to be huge box office hits. So that's my broad answer to this question. Dan, I'm sure you've got a perspective on what Tony said.
Look, so I'm going to take a different tack to you. So instead of shitting on our listener, I thought I'd actually sort of...
I'm not shitting on the listener. I'm just bringing my perspective to what he wrote to me. I'm glad he wrote to me and I'm not shitting on him at all.
Okay, well, anyway, look, what I'd say is that he's not necessarily maybe talking about things strictly. I mean, I know he sort of phrased it that way, but I don't think that's strictly what he's talking about. I don't think he was coming at it from a financial standpoint. I think he was talking about sort of cultural resonance. One thing that jumped out at me, and
what
this is the...
Let
me just swing back to what I'm about to say next, which I think probably speaks to that. So he made a very specific comparison point to a lot of TV programs that have been part of the cultural conversation of Australian product, which has been performing sort of well. So things like the Josh Thomas TV program, things like Bluey, which is genuinely a monster commercial hit. But the rest of those programs are generally programs which, yes, they've certainly had a cultural footprint. They're the sort of shows that the people I enjoy talking to are talking about those programs. The people that I like reading, sorry, I claimed earlier I couldn't read. I can actually read. It's really a thing. The people I like reading talk about those programs. Podcasts that I listen to, like, they talk about those programs as well. But by and large, a lot of those Australian exported TV programs aren't really sort of that broadly watched. They're just sort of very dominant in cultural conversation. And what I think is indicative of the Australian industry and suddenly what is maybe sort of to the core of the conversation here is that I think to the detriment of the Australian film industry, it has become, as Simon's referred to it, as an artistically orientated industry. And it's not necessarily producing anywhere near enough commercial hits and really talking to mainstream audiences in the way that a small industry probably really should be. Part of the issues around movies broadly over the last sort of 25 years is if you sort of think about movies from, we'll say like the 70s through to the late 90s, early 2000s. So I was kind of right at the end of that, where myself and my university going friends would all be talking about the big movies of the time. So as I was graduating uni, so we're talking about things like, say, Lost in Translation and Royal Tenenbaums and those kind of modest sort of art house film successes of the time. Movies were just this really vibrant thing that were part of that cultural conversation. And it continued to be that way for like another 5 or 6 years sort of post my university sort of, tenure. But at that point, that's where you started seeing things, and this taps into the conversation from earlier, which was the rise of largely HBO programs, but a bit of FX and some other stuff in there, where it stopped being about like the... Wait, Simon, just let me get... I'm coming back full circle to it. So we started talking about TV shows as the dominant sort of culture. So it sort of seemed as though there was a shifting where the more artistically orientated people were no longer talking about movies in the way that they were. Instead, they were talking about TV programs. And that DVD binge consumption...
That's not my experience. I don't believe that to be true.
Simon, it's not your experience because as I'm talking about, I'm talking about like the young person experience and you're like 50 years beyond that. So... where I'm coming at from, Simon, is where the dominant conversation was with the sort of youth culture, there was an interest in movies as being the real sort of dominant form. But TV started taking over. Now, those TV shows that became part of that cultural conversation, they weren't the most broadly watched TV programs, but they have replaced that cultural conversation because the sort of hip, cool people that were going out watching a lot of indie films suddenly gravitated onto these TV programs and things like a lot of those Australian shows that he's watching. That's the same audience. This is the same types of people that are watching those programs as we're watching the cool sort of indie or art house or more progressively interesting cinema of the 70s through to the early to mid 2000s. So you've got this sort of change of cultural conversation. Which doesn't mean that these things have less...
Which still exist and exist on a year-to-year basis. You can throw up the HBO, the Prestige, the Wire, and all that sort of stuff you keep throwing up. While you're discovering that, discovering that era of television, the films are still being released and are still being discussed and are still being referenced by those that... are leaning towards that, are gravitating towards that sector of the film industry. With the blossoming and the burgeoning of streaming and cable and all that sort of stuff, yes, there's going to be a whole lot more content that is discussed, and that's fine as well. That's an opportunity where the TV grabbed and ran with and did a wonderful job with. But the quality films and the impact that they had, whether in mainstream or art house, never went away.
Okay, look, I'd say that they changed, and that's exactly what I was about to say, which was that sort of younger audience, I'm about to say, Simon, that younger audience who are watching it have gravitated over towards the sort of premium drama and the streaming side of things, and so that cinema experience, that art house, specialty cinema audience has changed somewhat. So the films that are being made now actually align with where that Australian film industry, I think, has been sort of gravitating towards since the early to mid-90s, which is more towards that art house sort of scene. And it's more towards older viewers, I'd say probably more 50-plus, than it was really talking to younger viewers who were attending sort of the art house theatres in droves to watch a lot of, culturally buzzy movies of the time. And so you look at the films that have been culturally buzzy. The ones that have been culturally buzzy that are talking to younger audience are pretty much the same movies that from a just art house conversation broadly have been talking to younger viewers, and it's that horror space. So within the horror space, I think younger viewers are still watching these movies in really big numbers, and that's evidenced by Talk to Me. But I'd say broadly, what our listeners are really tapped upon is just that culture conversation has moved elsewhere, and the Australian industry, the film industry, just isn't really being part of that conversation anymore. And so as it's becoming more sort of orientated around the political whims and interests of the various film funding bodies. It's sort of shifting away from where that mainstream cultural zeitgeisty consideration is. And that's where I think the email is coming from. I think he's talking about it in terms of cultural value, maybe not necessarily in terms of that box office dollar.
The best and worst thing that ever happened to this film industry was 1994. In 1994, the people who were coming out of the 10BA program of the late 70s and early 80s in the Australian film industry, where very commercial films were being made as tax write-offs, and a lot of commercially minded filmmakers were honing their skills, that led to distributors and producers thinking, we can do what we did with that, but we can do it on a grand scale. And in 1994, that culminated with Priscilla and with Muriel dominating the box office in only a way that those films can, to a certain extent. And, of course, we had a huge hit with Crocodile Dundee along the way as well. But that was more to do with the phenomenon that was Paul Hogan at the time and his popularity. But having said that, now everything that happened in 1994 is, why can't we have another Muriel? Why can't we have another Priscilla? And those are the blockbuster mainstream numbers that are always tossed up when people look at the film industry and say, oh, we just don't make them like we used to. All we're doing is making these inner city movies and these art house movies. And that's true, but it's not a measuring point, it's not a barometer via which we can continue to judge the films of this film industry. We're just not being governed by, and more to what you say is that those that were sort of trained on prestige television or prestige projects in other mediums are now gravitating towards film, and that's why we're seeing films like Warwick Thornton's The New Boy or Judd Clark's Sweet As or The Royal Hotel from Kitty Green. They're films that embrace those elements and do it on a big screen way. Look, it's frustrating to continually have to defend a film industry that has measured success against a film industry from a bygone era that had blockbuster success. We're not that anymore. And when something like Talk to Me comes along and tops out at 93 million around the world, but is still not considered worthy enough to be considered a major local hit, then what are you going to do? And then you've got the other side of that, which is Elvis, which is Peter Rabbit, which is all the superheroes, the Matrixes, which all come out here and use our facilities to be blockbuster films. Then you get people outside the industry saying, why is that being included as an Australian film? That's what's doubly frustrating. There isn't a positive spin on the industry that you can put to someone who's of the mindset that Tony is, where he says, we don't have those sort of blockbusters anymore. Well, we do. You've got to know where to look for them.
I mean, look, okay, a couple of things here. So first of all, if we're going to talk about it as being a film industry, being part of an industry means that there should be some sort of real interest in revenue generation taking place. And instead what we have is an industry that's more interested in making the last stage of Shenmue than they are, how's that one? Making a film like that rather than maybe something which is actually driving audience attention. If you're going to be a film industry, you need to play to both sides.
Well, you can't say that the same week that The Dry 2 came out. You can't say that the same year that Blueback had people packing in over the Christmas period or a few years after The Dry was in. We have films that are making money. They're done on a budget. You look at Shader, which has now travelled all around the world to all sorts of acclaim. It's made a lot of money for its investments. Of an Age is the same sort of thing, but we're trying to judge it against what we define as profitable measures. They're profitable films.
Yeah. Again, I don't think that we were really necessarily talking as much about profit at the beginning, and I don't think that's the overall intention as to what Tony's getting to here. I think it is that sort of cultural value and cultural worth. The reason why I talk to you probably hasn't necessarily registered with him is, I don't know who Tony is, but I'm going to presume he's not a horror guy. And I'll admit, like, I was certainly aware of the movie because I pay attention to box office figures coming in and out, but like, it's not really a film that culturally really had any sort of resonance with me. But broadly, like, I don't know why we don't have Australian movies which do have some actual audience sort of interest. The only thing I'd say that's actually been like a real commercial hit in the last two, like last 4 to 5 years, is the two dry movies. But what I would say about the dry movies is that they're both playing to audiences who I think are older film viewers. Like, I don't know how old Tony is. Like, I'm going to guess that he's, you know, possibly sort of getting up to my age thereabouts. Okay, and it's probably come about as a person who was watching a lot of art house films in the 90s going into the 2000s and has found himself a little bit starved as a result of that. Like, he's now gravitated elsewhere and he's followed that cultural conversation to where that's gone. Everything else, like, it just kind of feels like it's playing too art house or too old for that broader mainstream chat. And this isn't just an Australian cinema issue. I think this is a issue which is really facing a lot of art house specialty cinema.
Okay. Although, we've addressed your problem, Tony.
I said that. I think that's where the cinema industry has been going, but I'm going to be really interested to see what happens over the next 5 years, because the trends that we're seeing is that a lot of the audiences that were turning out for these sort of older orientated movies aren't going to the movies anymore. COVID has, and justifiably so, changed the marketplace
incorrectly sweeping statement.
Hello. You haven't even said the statement yet. Broadly, COVID has... I'm finishing my statement and then you can attack it. But broadly, there's a lot of viewers who are coming out to movies who justifiably have been staying away from the cinema. And so you're starting to see like that really reliable, constant stream of films that were there for that 50, 60, 70 plus audience that are actually starting to dry up a little bit. And so I'm wondering if the industry is going to pivot a little bit and try to find some of those lapsed viewers as it's starting to really sort of make a justification is not the right word, but try to create a more stable market, I guess, in that art house specialty space. And when you look at films like, say, Past Lives, for example, that's probably exactly the direction it needs to be heading in. Commercial, but still artistically minded, and talking to the youth audience about things which are on their mind.
All righty. So, listeners, letter Tony Kendall, thank you for giving us inspiration for a fiery intermission segment. Dan Barrett, what else have you been watching?
I've been watching the rundown that we created for this podcast because Simon naively earlier said, oh yeah, we'll address that email, but we just give a, you know, like a minute or two at the beginning of the show. And I'm like, no, it should probably be an intermission. And it's like, no, we haven't got enough to talk about there. Sorry. What else have I been watching? The Daily Show is what I've been watching and obsessing over. So look, I am part of that audience who, look, I mean, this is like exactly what I was talking about a second ago, which is perceptions versus the reality a little bit, in that we all thought we were watching a show from a very specific sort of viewpoint, but we weren't. There was always that conversation about, oh, the Daily Show is where the young people get their news from. That was never the case at all. The audience for the Daily Show, I came across the Daily Show a little bit earlier than a lot of my peers, but like I was on the young end of people watching The Daily Show in my early to mid-20s. Most of the audience for The Daily Show have always been like 30s, 40s, and 50s. And as The Daily Show got older, so too did its audience. The Daily Show was almost never where young people got their news. The Daily Show was the place where people under the age of 65 were getting their news. So that was always a misnomer. But for people like me who did watch a lot of Jon Stewart back in the day, it was such a joy to turn on the TV Tuesday Australian time, to watch on YouTube, of all places, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart back. He got on there and look, I mean, if we'd seen a continuum where he hadn't stepped away in 2015 and was hosting to this point, I'm sure his presentation style would be quite different and we'd be watching a very different performer. But it is almost like he was trapped in amber, grayed up a little bit, given a little bit more facial hair and pushed back out on the stage because the cadence was very similar. The presentation style was very similar. Oh, yeah. And what was fun is that towards the end of his tenure, you could see it was a guy that was a bit tired of hosting that show. He'd been doing it for like 15 years at that point. But the Jon Stewart we saw this week, like he seemed like he was having fun being back out there. And there were some novels he toured and there was vibrancy and he pissed off a lot of people over some supposed both-siderisms. And if you actually listen to what he had to say, like that wasn't really what he was talking about. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I had a great time. And Jon Stewart, thank you for re-entering my life because there was no way I was watching that Apple TV Plus show because boy, was that dull. Simon, what else have you been watching?
I agree. I managed to see The Daily Show thanks to the links you provided. So it was great to see him back. The opening sequence where he was in fine form, that middle section where he crossed to all his correspondents, who I think are going to be the people who take over the chair when he's not there on Mondays, that showed a great chemistry and was very funny as well. So I think The Daily Show is back like it never went away. What else have I been watching, Dan Barrett? I watched a film called Polaris. Now, this is a home entertainment release. It has been sent to DVD here in Australia. It's also available on all the digital platforms. It is a Canadian film that stars an incredible young Australian-Chinese actress called Viva Lee as a young girl who is trying to survive in the Arctic wilderness in a future hundreds of years hence. Imagine Mad Max, but in the snow, and Max is played by a little girl, and you have some idea what you're getting with Polaris. Polaris is the North Star of legend in the Northern Hemisphere, and it is the star that she's heading towards to try to reunite with her people. Along the way, there are hordes of elk skin wearing baddies who are desperate to get in her way at any opportunity. Be warned, although it stars a little girl, this has some really brutal Mad Max style violence in there. And it has some of the most beautiful scenery you'll see in a long time. This one bypassed the movies, has gone straight to home video in this country, although it was a bit of a hit over in its homeland of Canada. Do try and check out Polaris. I think it's one of the great unsung films of the last couple of years.
Where's it from?
It's from Canada.
Canada. Hey, Simon, what is this movie? Canada. Yes. Sorry, I just lost my earpiece. This is where all my information's fed. I've never actually said an original thought on this podcast. It's always fine to do my piece. There is a movie that is playing screens right now. It is a Canadian movie, and the name of the title, I'm trying to do it off the top of my head. It's like Humanist Vampire Seeking. Do you know what I'm talking about here?
Consensual victim. Yes. I'm glad you brought it up. We're actually giving away some tickets for that. Sensitive suicidal person. Yes, yes. It's a love story in which a vampire doesn't have the real killing instinct. So she sends out messages to try to get someone who's suicidal so that she can feed and they can get their way. But as things develop, it becomes a love story and things don't quite go as either of them planned. Very strange film, very sweet film, lovely romantic sort of storyline to it, all wrapped up in the conventions of a vampire horror story. So, yeah, interesting movie.
Yeah, why aren't you reviewing that on the show?
I haven't seen it. They haven't sent me a link yet, and I never leave the house. So, I'm waiting to see it. But I'm keen to see it because it's had some great sort of reviews calling it the next big cult film. But you can win tickets for it over on my Science Fiction Film Festival page. So get on over there and enter the contest. Okay, this week in history. Dan Barrett, February 20, 1983, for the first time in the history of sports broadcasting, what was introduced into CBS's coverage of the Daytona 500 car race?
So I've got much in there for you to unpack. I've got no idea, but I was taking, it was like 1983 was the year you said, right?
Yeah,
eventually. Yeah, so look, there's some technological advances which take place at times that are more recent than people realize, particularly in broadcasting. So from the early 80s through the early 90s, we saw such a rapid progression in terms of what was presented to us on TV. And so I just tried to think from a perspective of 1983, what sort of innovations could have happened then that are possibly happening later in time than I think they probably should have. And I'm wondering if the technology we're talking about here, am I on the right path talking about it's a technology like this? Yep.
Oh, exactly. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Is it the ability to like go back to like recent tape and watch it through? I don't know how I want to phrase it, but no? Okay.
No. Instant replay, digital replay. No, for the first time in car racing history, they put a camera in the car. They had 360-degree camera. inside the car.
Okay. Cool. Yeah.
February 22, 1973. Released on this day, the Dutch blockbuster Turkish Delight introduced which director and his favorite leading man to international audiences?
Yeah, I have no idea.
1973. Okay. The director was one Paul Verhoeven. And his leading man was Rutger Hauer. Turkish Delight was a huge hit at the 70s. It was the biggest. It is. It's still one of the biggest Dutch films ever made, and it traveled the world and got those two their gigs in the US, helped get their gigs in the US. And finally, February 23, 1997, which film makes its network debut ad-free and uncensored to an audience of 65 million viewers?
The fact it was ad-free makes me think Schindler's List.
It is definitely Schindler's List. Well done, sir. Okay, now to wrap things up in a very saucy version of the birthday quiz, it's the birthday quiz.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
Okay.
Daniel Barrett.
How saucy is this getting? Like, should I be doing the top button up? Or undone?
No, leave it done up for Christ's sake. Okay. What is going to happen is we're going to have to get a little E sticker next to our Apple podcast because this could get a little rude. February 21, 1979, Jennifer Love Hewitt. February 21, 1961, Christopher Atkins. February 22, 1969, actor Thomas Jane. And February 23, 1983, the lovely Emily Blunt. Now, they've all played a character on screen that has this profession. What might it be?
This profession? Okay, so... yeah, okay, I've got it. They've all been prostitutes. So, Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Not quite close. First of all, the term is sex worker. The second of all, it's... down that path, but it's not quite that.
Prostitute, sex worker, it's fine. People who are sex workers call themselves prostitutes. It's okay. This is wokeness gone mad, Simon. Wokeness gone mad. Thomas Jane, I'm pretty sure, was the star of HBO's Hung, where he played very well-endowed man who I believe decided to make the most of it. Jennifer Love Hewitt, I remember there being a lot of jokes about her giving hand jobs to people based on the movie poster or TV show poster, whatever it was around at the time. And that's all I've got. But I connected those two, and I kind of feel that I'm on the right path now.
Well, I did warn everyone about the rudeness of this section. No, they all played strippers.
Strippers?
They all played strippers. Jennifer Love Hewitt played an exotic dancer in the TV show The Client List. Christopher Atkins, One Night in Heaven, which was directed by John G. Alvordson, the man behind Rocky. But, hey, what are you going to do? Thomas Jane. Yeah.
Are we allowed to say strippers? If I can't say prostitute, you can't say stripper.
What other word would you use for stripper?
Unclothed
worker.
Well, it technically wouldn't be an unclothed worker.
Thomas Jane, I am a little surprised you didn't get this because I know it's one of your favourite movies. He played Todd Parker, a Hardy Boy stripper in Boogie Nights.
Oh, of course he did.
Emily Blunt, she, in last year's Netflix movie Pain Hustlers, opposite Chris Evans, she played the woman who started off as a exotic dancer, but then went into the world of selling illegal drugs to chemists, or drugs that should have been illegal to chemists. So they were all strippers. There you go. Saucy stuff.
Again, so, Simon, let's not say stripper. Let's say unclothed gig worker.
Unclothed dancer. All right. Okay. So there you go. That's the end of the podcast. Good job. And by you, I mean the listeners can go to Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast, on Threads or on YouTube at Screen Watching, or you can email us like Tony did. And it was a great email. It actually got us talking and got us thinking. Thank you, Tony. Screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com.
You're right. Folks, if you want to find some of my common sense, laying down the law as it really is, check out alwaysbewatching.com. It's a daily newsletter. By daily, that means it comes out Monday through Friday and occasionally Saturday if I forget to send my bonus Friday email on a Friday afternoon. Yeah, it's 5 emails through the week. It's all the big stories in TV streaming and a little bit of movie stuff. But largely movie stuff if it's streaming. And then on Friday afternoons, I send a guide to the movies and TV shows that debuted that very week. So this isn't one of those guides where it's like, hey guys, maybe you want to see what's going to come up over the next 7 days where you'll probably forget about this by the time that it's actually available. This is what happened in the last 7 days. Press play on this, go off and watch it right now. That's what that newsletter is all about.
That makes a lot of sense. I'm going to forego my weekly screen space plug, screen-space.net, and instead drop in there. I'll be in Melbourne next week for the Melbourne leg of the Melbourne Science Fiction Film Festival, now with added place name in the title, thanks to the advice from my marketing guru, Dan Barrett, who thinks that science fiction film festivals held in Melbourne should be called Melbourne Science Fiction Film Festivals. At Cinema Nova from Friday night through to Sunday night, I'll be there for all those days. Do come down, say hello. Don't say hello if you don't buy a ticket. Buy a ticket, then come and say hello, and I'll be a much happier person. So see you down there. Cinema Nova.
So what day will you be in Melbourne from?
I am hanging around Thursday night in Sydney for the June 2 screening. And then I'll be down from early Friday morning in the Melbourne.
Okay.
Sunday afternoon.
Cool. Sorry, I could have left that for our production meeting, but yeah, I've got some scheduling issues next week, but we'll discuss that off microphone. Folks, we may be back next week. We may have a bye week. We'll find out. Anyway, folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week or the week after. We'll see you then.